Welcome to the official podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation, a think tank for the self-governing Christian. In a time when Christians are looking for answers in revival, rapture, or the religious right, Chalcedon presents a comprehensive biblical worldview that calls believers to their covenant responsibilities in order to advance Christ's kingdom in every area of life.
Welcome to the 66th episode of the Chalcedon Podcast. Today is May 24th, 2026, and Mark Rush Dooney, Chalcedon's president, and Martin Salbretti, Chalcedon's vice president, are joining me, your host, Andrea Schwartz, for a discussion on the nature of the American system. In his book by the same name, Dr. R.J. Rush Dooney describes an America with which most living today are unfamiliar. Why? Because we have been served a steady diet of a secularized version of history, divorced from the Christian roots of our nation. When people who come to understand that they have been deceived as to what the American system is all about, what they discover is that America, both in colonial times and then as a new nation, although it had its flaws, it also had a biblical foundation that the enemies of God claim the results as coming from something quite different than the application of God's law and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so let's start off, Mark. Today, the last 10 years, we've heard "Make America Great Again." That's thrown around. Do you think most people understand what, in fact, made America great?
I think we're extremely ignorant of American history and its origins. And I think what passes for patriotism long before the Trump era is really a form of nationalism. And we don't really know what made America great. We don't know what a great America would be, except in these general categories that would make a nation strong, powerful, independent, wealthy. And I think that's what people envision. And that's all they can envision when they hear the term "Make America Great Again." Now, we can go back and there are things that we don't like about what's happened in America to our rights, to our Constitution, our liberties, our money, any number of things in the last, well, within our lifetime and even before. And we can say, well, we'd like to see some of that reversed. We'd like to see certain things undone, certain really of the worst policies of the last half century or century begin to be unraveled. But they don't have the root cause of why America was great. Essentially, America was great because it had a very strong Christian ethic. And that was reflected to a large extent, not perfectly, but it was reflected to a large extent in the structure of the United States. But once that moral foundation was lost and the faith is no longer there, the moral ethic disappears very quickly. And then the structure that is left, the constitutional framework, means relatively little. The Constitution doesn't work well when you have a people divorced from the faith that made it workable.
And what you have here is a sense of erosion of the value of the United States. When you talk about greatness, it's a value judgment. And so people make this assessment that we've fallen from some kind of height. But as Mark pointed out correctly, we don't have a proper sense of what that actual height was. We have an artificial sense that's been spoon-fed to us in the public school systems, in particular in academia. And so their view of what a nation is going to follow rather statist models, in fact, by and large, and not have a moral component to it. And consequently, the kind of ideas that are going to be put forward for making America great again inevitably involve continual and worsening violation of God's law, which, by the way, actually weakens a nation, not strengthens it. So the path to strengthen a nation as such is not the path that's going to be proposed by statists, because they simply want statism to become more and more powerful and stronger. And so their vision of this is a very, very different one than where we have. So we are correct in saying there was an erosion from a great height. We fell from a great height. But what that height looked like, we have a wrong idea of it. So that's why I think Dr. Rush Dooney's book here is very informative in laying out the details of where we actually started as Christian colonies, each one chartered separately, and how they functioned and what was important to them and what made them great, and what we threw away in the process of historically devolving and decaying from that high point. And Dr. Rashtuni, in this very short chapter, articulates each of the steps by which that was chipped away until we were left with what we have today, which is a fairly empty statist framework that is already half a foot into the grave of socialism. And that's because of all these other steps that took place. And until you retrace all this and understand the steps, you're not likely to come up with a good solution. You're not going to come up with a moral solution. You're not going to see the theological things that occurred and the power distribution that was readjusted in order to pull the power away from the morality and then essentially centralize it in the person of the state. And so statism writ large is what we're dealing with, as Mark indicated, and that's what we need to actually reverse. And so long as you're still hold or drinking the statist Kool-Aid, your solution to for making America great again will be a false one, and in fact will continue to worsen our situation. You get symptomatic relief of maybe A, B, and C, but because all the other fundamentals are horrendously out of whack with God's law, the God's curse abideth on us as a consequence, and that is for our own protection, by the way. If we were allowed to run riot and get away with continual violations of God's law, and there were no consequences, then we'd be in a world of hurt. But God actually has built into his universe moral consequences for the violation of his laws, and we're going to be facing many of them as a nation if we haven't already. Already we know have violated the rules that where Leviticus says, if you keep my laws, then the sword shall not pass through your nation. But we've given up that because, of course, we violate his laws. Therefore, we are not owed any protection by God in his covenantal promise to us. And so you take this on every step, economics, the education, politics in general, you'll see that we have created a new false God, and God is not going to honor that. And no matter how much gold you put a patina on the statue that you've invented, it will fail you. It is a false God. And as all false gods do, they deliver disaster.
One time I think I was having a discussion with someone, and we said that if you wanted to sum up most of the work that Dr. Rashtuni has done, you could say, quote, Psalm 127, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain that build it. And so if we don't understand what built America, right? And one of the things that I think has been missing in education is a biblical philosophy of history. People have accepted that what's ever in a book must be true. But Rush wrote the book, The Biblical Philosophy of History, and he talked about that there are no brute facts. Mark, what does it mean that there are no brute facts? Is that just like that's something you say, but it doesn't have a lot of things behind it?
Those facts don't exist independently. Facts are interpreted facts, and they're interpreted in a moral context. What do those facts mean? And of course, they're going to mean something different to a Marxist versus a Christian. And so the facts of history or anything else have to be understood in a worldview within a context. The Christian has a worldview that is based upon the fact that God is the creator and sustainer, and that he ultimately the judge of all things, and that we're accountable to him. So at least a Christian worldview is going to begin grounded in a worldview that has some basis to legitimacy in Scripture. Whether their applications and their understanding of those facts are entirely correct is another matter. But at least we have a context. So facts have to be understood within this moral context. They have to be interpreted facts. Ideas are very important. And the history of ideas and where ideas are coming from, is this really a Christian idea? Or is this, for instance, a Marxist idea? Is this a Hegelian idea? Is this a dualistic idea? Where are these ideas with which history and facts are interpreted coming from? That becomes extremely important.
And it becomes important, as Mark is indicating, because if it is a brute fact that is an uninterpreted fact just sitting out there, then man is in control by inferring and imposing meaning on it, then man is the determiner of all meaning. And he can say, therefore, this fact means this, and that fact means that, regardless of what Scripture says. And so most of the time, men, when they operate autonomously, are definitely not operating in parallel with Scripture, but in opposition to Scripture, because you're intent on building a Tower of Babel. And so the world of brute facts is the path to Babel, where men then determine the meaning of all these facts. So economic fact is determined by man. It is not a given in the reality that we have. So whatever God has to say about economics is ignored entirely, because it's not a pre-interpreted fact because of God's creating the fact. It is a fact that just happens to exist, and we as man give it the value. And a Marxist, like Marx says, will give it a different sense than a Christian would have. And the only fact that actually matters is what God's interpretation is going to be. And if we've lost track of that, if we've lost touch with God himself, if we've refused to obey him, then we have no other source of meaning to couch our worldview, our perspective. Our perspective is then going to be controlled by humanism and by whatever the public schools are propagating in the name of humanism. That becomes the matrix for understanding all these facts, including the facts of American history. So I'll give an example I think is kind of important, and hope we discuss it further in the course of this conversation. But when Dr. Rushdoony says positive things about feudalism, you know what comes to my mind? I remember very distinctly in school being told that feudalism was this primitive system that we've long since outgrown, and thank God it's no longer part of the landscape. Except this is the exact opposite of what Scripture contends for, that feudalism is actually the more biblical perspective and actually gives far more benefits to it. And it is maligned and slandered on purpose and by academia to make it sound like we've outgrown these early primitive notions about feudalism. So if Dr. Rushdoony happens to promote it, then of course he's mocked and laughed and slandered too, saying we don't want that. It's not as if he's saying we're going to have an agrarian culture. It can be very technologically advanced, but feudalism in terms of how the power is actually distributed among to people to maximize their liberty to realize their potential in God's world. So until we start to recover some of these terms that have been hijacked and subverted, we're going to be in a world of hurt, and we're going to be in the world of the brute facts, which is the facts as humanists insist they are, all open for human reinterpretation. And then when men interpret the facts, they force it on other men. That's what the universities are for. That's what the media is for, to impose those interpreted facts, humanist interpreted facts, upon us. And then we have to kowtow to that. You can get in pretty serious trouble, apparently, if you disagree with policy on COVID vaccinations, for example, or other policies, whatever it might be that is that has been determined by the high and mighty. Then that becomes a political reality or a legal reality, even if it conflicts with Scripture. Now, of course, God's going to go to work on that, just as he goes to work on every Tower of Babel, and to confound it, to sap its strength, and to disclose its foundations as being fragile and meaningless. So whenever men attempt to interpret outside of God's reality, they are imposing a fiction on their fellow man for the intent of tyrannizing their fellow man.
And that you can see how the introduction of the public school system in the early 1800s was the first steps in this, because I went to school. I know history as if there's only one view of history. And so, as you pointed out, the university, but it starts much earlier than that. And then you convince people, you know, you're a parent, you're not capable of teaching your children, so give it to the experts to do. And then after a while, we've lost this feudal sense, as you pointed out, in terms of things being local. So one of the things I was going to ask you, Martin, is it not true that if God's word is not applied locally, it will never change the culture? And the whole move away from the localism of early America has left us to a point where most people don't even know. I mean, they know who the president is, but that's about it.
Yeah, I think Dr. Rushdoony does us a tremendous service by pointing out that the actual basic political unit in the colonies and the early constitutional era also were the counties. That's where everything really mattered. In fact, counties could actually mint coins. It wasn't something that the states necessarily did, but it could be done by separate counties. And that's a kind of a fascinating notion when you think about it, because it shows that the federal government was acknowledging its limitations. But by rejecting limitation, it now adopts a position, the federal government, of having all power. It becomes what the scriptures called a pantocrator, the all-powerful, a term normally reserved for Christ. But nowadays, the state says there's no authority higher than we are. And consequently, they act on that action. So in the educational domain, yeah, we're going to see from top to bottom, no room left for the Christian position to be properly represented, certainly not favorably represented, or as a solution, because they don't want to have a solution that requires regeneration. As we pointed out in a recent Arise and Build article, man is offended with the notion that he is a sinner and needs to be regenerated. So he throws that off the table immediately. And that means everything he's doing is okay. It's not sinful for him to have a corrupted, debauched currency. But see, that's what the counties were doing then. By the way, when you have control of, say, currency at the county level, you have accountability and responsibility. You knew exactly who was controlling the mint, and you could, so-called, and you would then have some ability for recourse if something is unjust in what's going on. So by localizing power, it not only restricts it, but it also makes it more responsible. When it's way off there in Washington, D.C., and all power is centered and controlled over there, this, I think Dr. Rishtuni correctly points out, is a method of subversion. It subverts the biblical position to centralize power when, in fact, it's intended to be very, very decentralized. Every man under his own vine and fig tree is kind of the vision that the scripture gives for us for it. So it has to be localized, and you cannot have a solution from the top down. I think Josiah's revival in 2 Chronicles 34 exhibits the weaknesses of a top-down revival. He did amazing things, and the people loved him because he was popular. But after he was gone, we were just two kings away from dispersion to Babylon. That's because the revival did not sink in deep into the people's hearts, and they left some things undone and didn't see any reason to fix everything. Because, of course, Josiah did not either. So a revival must be from the ground up. We talk about grassroots all the time, but that's a scriptural notion that if the root is healthy, then, of course, the tree will be healthy. And we have to understand that the roots are the individuals and then the counties and then finally the states and then the federal level. By reversing this process, then we put all power at the top. And this, of course, leads to corruption. It also leads to a massive violation of God's law on many, many scales. And worst of all, it means that you're creating a false god at this highest level of power.
So your dad mentions in this book that America underwent a second revolution. He also points out that the first was not a revolution. It was a war of independence. You didn't have chaos and anarchy. You said no, the people said no, we want to go to a legitimate form of government, and they were experiencing it. At what point does he identify that this second American revolution took place?
Well, there were a number of factors in it. Key, as I intimated earlier, was the loss of the Christian faith, particularly the strong Puritan element in American history. It had been in decline even before the Constitution was written, but what replaced it was Unitarianism, which passes as a Christian denomination, but it's not. It denies the Trinity, and it's essentially very humanistic. And the early Unitarians very early moved into forms of socialism and socialist thinking. And socialist thinking is always very statist. So there was a move away from the limited government of the Constitution towards a form of nationalism and controlling the future and controlling man for his betterment. In other words, the state now was the primary agency, and the focus was on the nation rather than the liberties. There's a phrase that's commonly used, that we're a free nation, we're a free country. But really, the freedoms that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were looking at were not the freedoms of a nation, which is a very large collective abstract noun. They were the freedoms of the individuals. And you cannot have a free people unless you have freedoms for individuals. And this is something that has been progressively lost. So the Second American Revolution is this progressive loss of freedom. And another aspect of that, encouraged by the Unitarians and socialists, was statist education, as you intimated a short time ago. The turning public schools into government schools run by the elite statists, the experts, and the loss of parent rights was advocated very early on in the 19th century, and it's only progressed since then.
In fact, we should not be surprised at some of this. Dr. Rishtuni, I think, gives an example from the mid-1800s of a law that was written that made it a crime for a parent to criticize what a teacher is doing or teaching. And so we're kind of getting back to that kind of situation as well. And, you know, the parents are not the ones that are paramount in the training of their children. The state is now becoming in loco parentis. They take the place of the parent. That's because the state believes they're the sole repository of all value, and everything that's important is done by the state. If it's not done by the state, it's done by lesser entities like families, and these other lesser entities often are parochial in their approach. They're going to be pro-family, and therefore the state's mission all the way up to the United Nations is to block that, is to say, no, we have a higher calling and a more beautiful vision of what mankind should achieve. And it means, of course, setting aside any of the prerogatives of the family unless it happens to coincide with what the state wants to do. So I agree with both Mark and Andrea here that one of the pivotal moments was when state education was being promoted by Horace Mann and the others. That was a big engine. And of course, one of the mechanisms by which it made it possible was to make it free. And so at that point, they tickled the pocketbooks of the Christians, who were then willing to give up some ground in this area. After all, if they felt, what could they possibly teach that would be conflicting with us? And we would control that. Lo and behold, parents have very little control today. In fact, their children can be forced to do certain things. And now, of course, that kind of control is being extended where possible into homeschooling and Christian schooling in terms of curriculum, in terms of other parameters. They say, well, we're only tolerating Christian schools. We're only tolerating the homeschooling because the real education happens when the state does it. And that's incorrect. In fact, the state's better at maleducating people than educating them. And I think that's really the point. They maleducate because they want no contention against the state's principles. And so we've lost that. The United States was not founded on the idea that the families were the last people to have a say-so on how their children would be raised. Rather, they had a very strong Christian ethic. But when that deteriorates and it decays, and you can buy people out by saying, we'll give you a free education, you don't have to pay for it, then all bets are off.
And what's interesting is, even today, I have many conversations. Sometimes I irritate people ad nauseum, and I'm corrected by leadership in certain churches that you shouldn't push this homeschooling idea. This isn't really a fundamental as being a Christian, right? And of course, it's Christian education we're talking about, whether it's at a private school or in the home. But see, they missed the foundation. The humanist says man is basically good. And this very positive view of people, and you can be anything you want to be. Well, who would have ever thought that God created the male and female would now mean you could be whatever you wanted to be? So people even get too focused on our school isn't that bad. But aside from that, they haven't educated themselves. If they've been schooled in humanism, they're going to think, well, we'll just find a good humanist school. So I think it's not just the education of children that has to be emphasized. It's the re-education, because we have to revise the history that these people have been taught.
I should point out that one of the interesting elements in this first chapter of this book, which is highly recommended, one of the earlier books by Dr. Rushdoony, still very powerful. See, points out that there's two elements to the revolution, so-called, what we were trying to recover. The first element of dispute, and I've never heard this before until I read it from Rushdoony, was there was a religious dispute between us and Parliament, and we're asking the King of England to intervene because the Parliament was attempting to control us and to then determine which churches would be which. So this was a big deal. It was a theological component to the revolution, and that's never mentioned in the secular books that I've ever read, and I've gone through the whole public school system into college, and I know what they will and will not teach, and that is absent. So, and then the second part, they also leave out too. They reinterpreted it as something very different, like they're going to set aside and make an Enlightenment-inspired rejection of Christian control. Rather, the second element that Dr. Rushdoony points out is the loss of localism, the destruction of localism, and then the presence of centralization, which in his book, Subversive Man, which is coming out this year, he points out that's one of the major ways to subvert a culture is to centralize power. It needs to stay decentralized, which keeps it much safer, closer to the reins of the people's control over it. And when we lose that, then we lose everything. And that's put forward by many, many different sources across the board. That's why people are nowadays even saying we need to have the United Nations step in and take control of everything. Again, centralization, one central Tower of Babel to fix everything. So you have this dispute here about the Anglican Church being imposed on the 13 colonies and then controlled in turn by Parliament. So even Anglicans didn't like the idea because they knew that sounds good at first, but in actual fact, it's Parliament that's going to be imposed as the religious authority of the colonies. So that's the first part. There was a theological component that's left off the table when secularists tell us our history. And the second part was an attack on localism. So when Dr. Rishtuni says the way to back is to recover those two elements because they were attacked for a reason. Those were the strong bulwarks that were necessary for us to protect ourselves and our liberties that we have here. And so what really meant that the things that we're facing today were actually what the colonists were facing against England in the 1700s, late 1700s. This is not a new battle, in other words. It's very instructive then to read what Dr. Rishtuni says and to suddenly see in it, wait a minute, that's happening today. That was happening in the 60s when Rishtuni wrote this. It's happening now in the year 2026 as we speak. So the exact same dynamic is present, and we're not seeing anything new here. The exact same things that Parliament and the King were doing to England are what our country is attempting to do to families, to counties, even to states. And the mechanisms by which this is done is exposed, and I guess you'll get into this, Andrea, but I think it's still so remarkable that the two things that are so critical that Dr. Rishtuni identifies are the very things that are absent from any humanist retelling of our history.
So, Mark, one of the things that your dad points out is terms change their meaning over time. And two of the terms that appear in some of the founding documents are charity and welfare. Discuss a little bit about how what we understand these things to be and who's responsible for them, as opposed to what the people then would have understood.
Well, the terms do change, and how we understand them change all the time. Within our own lifetime, terms have changed tremendously. In the 50s, the word gay was a very positive term to refer to someone as gay, and obviously that's completely changed its meanings within our lifetimes. But welfare didn't mean a handout in the 18th century. It meant well-being. It meant the general welfare meant the general well-being of the people. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights were intended to protect the liberties of the individuals, to allow for a good life. The Constitution was an interesting document. Historically, it was the first attempt to structure a government and put it in writing, in a document that tried to limit that government, to constrain that government, and to keep it within channels. And therefore, we had delegated powers. These are the powers that we were giving to the government and no more. And we've taken vague terms like general welfare and interpreted that in a very loosey-goosey way to say, well, we can encompass anything under there. And I think really the misuse of things like general welfare was intentional. There's a difference of opinion here, and Christians have had quite a debate on the Constitution itself and whether the Constitution was a good document or a bad thing. And I think the misuses of the Constitution really came intentionally. I think it was intentionally subverted, intentionally interpreted in a way according to people's worldview. And that worldview was becoming increasingly statist and socialist. And therefore, they wormed their way around the language through convoluted reasoning to do what they intended to do regardless. And I think now that's become entrenched in American constitutional law. It's become sacrosanct interpretations of some of these phrases because they're of such, it's like the doctrines and traditions of men of the Pharisees. This has now become part of our constitutional law because these interpretations have been around now for a couple hundred years. And so we can look at the Constitution and see, well, this is where it went wrong. Did it go wrong, or was it those who willfully twisted it into something it was never intended to be? And how could they twist it? It's because we were losing our Christian ethics, and we were looking for a means to do what the Constitution didn't really allow us to do. And so then we'll worm around it. It's just like, a teenager who wants to fudge the rules of the school. They'll look for technicalities, and sometimes it's absurd technicalities. But in their mind, they can skirt this rule by doing it something in a certain way. And I think that's what has happened to the Constitution over the course of many years. And so we do now have constitutional law that is based in absolute nonsense, but it's become part of our constitutional heritage. So it's going to be kind of a hard thing to undo, but it's something that has to happen.
When we speak about charity, Dr. Estrandi devotes some interesting historical insights to the matter. He gives an example, gives you the names, the states, counties that are involved, of a charity program that was privately funded, but then it was then switched over to state funding, government funding. And then the government then discovered that that was the route to political power. And so consequently, that grew and snowballed to the point that the funding for charitable needs outstripped the actual need for charity. So you then had to create occasions for people to want to get on the dole, which therefore actually weakened the character of the American people as a consequence when this came into play. So he says, make no mistake, when charity becomes political, it is not about charity, it's about power. And this is a very important insight that he brings to the table that I think we would be remiss in not emphasizing, because they talk a good line about being all for the what general welfare as misconstrued, as Mark pointed out, or for charitable causes. You don't want to be uncharitable, do you? But the reality is, it's all about the state accruing additional power so that all the entitlements that are now in place are so massive we could never pay for them. But the state has increased its power in the meantime, at least until everything collapses. And then it'll impose some new kind of currency on us and reinstitute power if we don't take steps to insulate and immunize ourselves against this. But you know, we are our own worst enemy in this regard. We've permitted it. We have let church-led and Christian-led charities decline and allowed actually those, when those coffers were confiscated by the state, we allowed it to happen. We didn't protest. And therefore, they would became nationalized, if you will, or made state property and state concerns. We know from Dr. Rishni's comments in other areas that in the Soviet Union during its most tyrannical era, it was a very dangerous position for you to help your neighbor, because to assist your neighbor in any way is a form of government. And the state wanted to be the only source of government, therefore it contended against it and would penalize and punish you if you extended help. They wanted people only to look to the state for help. And if you were an independent source of help, that meant you were an independent source of governance. And so the Christians have to recapture this point, because the entire premise that Dr. Estrandi brings out in this whole chapter is the importance of Christian self-government and how that is to be recovered and all the steps that were taken to demolish it and the great mountain that we have to climb to reacquire it and to reassert it responsibly.
So it's interesting to me that the more you give away, the less you even understand about the origin of it. I'll use an example. There, the various states, I think it's a state program, will give handicap stickers to people who are in some way impaired. But you have to officially go and get it. Now, if you break your foot and, you know, you're going to be in a cast for a while, it would be helpful to be able to park in one of those things. But it doesn't matter. If you don't have the certificate, you're not handicapped unless somebody says you're handicapped. A pregnant woman at the very end of her pregnancy probably would appreciate being able to park closer to the door. But then you can't even rely on people saying, well, of course, I'm not going to take that space because somebody who needs it. But in some parking lots today, most of the spaces are handicapped spaces, and you can't find a parking space if you're quote unquote not handicapped. So as soon as the state decides that, instead of people going, well, of course I'll leave that open for someone who needs it and count on the fact that people aren't going to abuse it, which would be Christian ethics in action, we have it so that nothing really is allowed unless the state says it should be allowed.
You know, it comes to mind the law of the Medes and the Persians that changeth not, right? Once the king or the emperor says something, it cannot be changed. And so we had this situation not too long ago, in the last 10 years, obviously since 9/11, where someone's name appeared on the no-fly list. But they even took it to court, and they could, and the government says, we can't. The computer is not so flexible for us to be able to remove his name. He must stay on that. Even though he's innocent and his name should not be on the list, it's going to stay on the list. Now, that's like the law of the Medes and the Persians, which changeth not. And I make light of it, but it shows the nonsense, as Mark pointed out, the nonsense that we put up with when state power is not uncontrolled, but is untethered even to reality, because there's no responsibility then. You say the state can do no wrong. We acknowledge the fault. We're sorry for the inconvenience, but you cannot fly, even though there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to fly. It's just that your name is on the computer list, and the computer list does not allow us to revise the list. So this is just a tip of the iceberg of how bureaucracies operate. But Dr. Rushdoony was not opposed to all the bureaucracy. He thought it was very useful in some areas, especially since it's tended to slow down government. But it has grown so massive and has been imbued with so much power that it becomes a source of horrendous dread. Certainly it was in the Soviet Union. And we are not far behind in terms of the power of the bureaucracies to impose upon us. We talk about the alphabet agencies that actually have the power. And that's what happened. Mark alluded to the enumerated powers that were restricted. But then how did Congress get around it? By setting up agencies and then have some kind of derivative power to do these things. And it takes an act of Congress or an act of the Supreme Court to even get rid of these agencies. They're like a tick that never will can be removed from your skin. And the parasitic nature of the state becomes most obvious when you try to remove the state program. I think the only program that's ever been successfully removed was prohibition, and it was a problem caused by this country. So that's not much of a track record on our part. And so Christians need to wake up and be part of the solution and not continually be aiding and abetting the enemy in its imposition of these restrictions on our liberty.
And I also think that there's a need for this localism in terms of creating businesses so that fellow believers can be hired, and that you would give priority to people that you know. Because I hear so many prayer requests, so-and-so is trying to get a job, and you know how hard it is to get a job. And my thought is, why are we not creating jobs? And why are we not, for example, you were homeschooled in a Christian setting? I'm looking for people like you. As opposed to, did you go to college? Do you have degrees and things like that? So I see you shaking your head, Mark. How do you see this would play out?
I thought that was necessary, and there's a need for people to do that, because the biggest headache most small to medium-sized businesses have is hiring employees. And once they hire them, it's whether they show up or not, whether they're reliable. There's a heavy turnover, particularly to entry-level positions. Finding qualified individuals, just finding people you can train to be qualified to do a job, people who have a modicum of integrity and honesty, would be a huge plus. I think there's a very real need for that in the church, and that would be a huge asset to actually solicit not just employees, but trainees towards a career in a particular profession. I would love to see that. And this is something that could be very productive in some of your, particularly in your larger churches that have a large number of people to draw with, and they could easily come up with a list of potential applicants for any type of a trainee position. I think that would be great. Apprenticeship, it would be a tremendous asset if Christians could rally behind that concept and developing an expertise in their own field.
You'd have to understand that the government has the civil government currently, statist government, has every reason to prohibit that. So as you keep raising the minimum wage that you have to pay someone who's not qualified to get that much money, I think you could cleverly arrange an apprenticeship program. I've tried to encourage this with people for years. Instead of shelling out all that money for college, find someone who's willing to apprentice your son or daughter. And then you pay the same thing in room and board that you might have to pay the college, or even give the person who's apprenticing your child some remuneration for the time spent. And 9 times out of 10, then he would want to hire this person because he's personally trained him. So it would be a win-win, but you'd have to understand that you're swimming upstream with the current, ideas.
And we've lost the sense of the guilds. which were basically groups that were collected around a skill, an important skill that mankind needed. My father himself was an apprentice in Stuttgart, Germany, in the typesetting field in the 50s, and then became a journeyman. This was the process which now today would be regarded as horrendous oppression on his part, but he gained the skill. He was able to emigrate to the United States and become a skilled typesetter here and run a typesetting shop in the graphics industry until he retired. But the path started with apprenticeship. But nowadays, it's considered oppressive to have someone become that. So it maybe it hides under names like mentoring and other programs where you take someone under your wing to raise them up to become self-articulating in terms of their future. But I do think we need to think outside the box and be aware that this state is going to place restrictions on it to do everything they can to disincentivize an apprentice program. We all agree here we should restore those programs. We now know that the state is going to set up all sorts of barriers to that. So we need to be clever as serpents, but gentle as doves as we navigate that particular minefield. That was not such a serious problem in the early days of America. It was premised on apprenticeship. Even Benjamin Franklin, who we were talking about before the broadcast, we know was an apprentice in a print shop and then became a proprietor of the Philadelphia Gazette, I imagine it was called. And so you rise to the top by earning your way. I believe Jesus as a carpenter was the same thing. The word was technon in the Greek. He was a technon, a skilled artisan who became, followed the steps of his stepfather Joseph and became a very well-skilled carpenter. But obviously more than a carpenter, as we all know. But yeah. That meant that that path had honor to it and value, corporate value to the collective, if you will. So everyone applying their skill the best they could was the way to go. It was the path forward. And we've lost that. And the early America had it, and we don't have it anymore. I'm not even sure it is present in any other scenario, simply because it's frowned upon as an abuse of the person being apprenticed. And it's not. But we've redefined all our terms and subverted them, so now it's considered catastrophic and unethical. And in fact, it is the path forward for them. They just simply have to have a status-approved path now, and that's where the lie rubs. The state would rather that you have no solution than a solution that is not statist, fascinatingly enough.
So let's finish up. We're coming to the end here. I think people are going to ask the question, what is revisionist history? Are we revising history to bring it back to a biblical roots? Or would people say, oh, what you're doing right now is you're just trying to revise history? What is revisionist history? And like the other things that we've talked about, does it have to come out of a worldview?
Well, history has to be understood in terms of a meaning, a context, and wouldn't be too hard for us to talk about any number of areas where world history, American history, has been revised by the secular humanist educational system. And the textbooks that are in any local high school are probably far different than what I read when I was in high school, probably even more so than what my father would have read when he was in high school. And even all the textbooks after the American Civil War reflected a more statist, nationalistic perspective. And so, yes, our understanding of history changes because the interpretation of history changes. So revisionist history means we're changing the narrative to a certain extent. Well, was that narrative we're changing the correct narrative? Was it accurate? Or was that itself a revision of what actually happened? So we have to dig a little deeper than what was taught 5 or 10 or 20 years ago, or even 50 years ago. We have to look at what really happened. So yes, revisionist history can be a negative term, but it can be a necessary positive change. And we do need to change how people understand history. Increasingly now, people are ignoring history as irrelevant, and they're making up history as they go along. And I think we're seeing that in the national discussion, probably in the last 10 years, more so than ever before. They're just creating a false history. And they can do that because if people have very little background in American history. So somebody's going to be revising history. They're going to be attempting to bring it in line with something, whether it's the truth or whether it's their ideology. But people are going to be interpreting history. So revisionist history can be good and it can be bad.
Yeah, if it's recovering the truth, that's important. When people read this particular book by Dr. Rushdoony, you encounter the footnotes. I mean, that's where there's a lot of the meat, and he supports, you know, the phrase today is bring your receipts, bring the proof of what you're saying. And he does, from original source materials and people far closer to the events than we are, who then give forth the meaning and the actual things that occurred and happened, what was going on, so that you can know, as he said, how what makes men tick and what caused these things to happen and set them in motion. So important is history that there was a famous magazine that put an article out. It was by Jeff Charlotte, and it was called Through the Glass Darkly, and it was an attack, not a very well-veiled attack against Dr. Rushdoony and his positions. He even made fun a little bit of listening to Dr. Rushdoony's American history tapes. Never said a single concrete thing about them other than that he listened to them, but he never interacted with them. And I replied to it in our what was then Faith for All of Life, and exposed all the errors in his analysis. And he had to say, well, when he read it, he laughed. He says, not because it was bad, but because it was so good, because obviously he had encountered somebody who could go toe-to-toe with him on these matters and bring forth the evidences necessary to then have a reassessment of Dr. Rushdoony's approach to history to establish that it wasn't just cockeyed off this cuff, but rather very deeply rooted in the actual source documents, which are the only place we can really pull history from unless we're going to impose it from on high, such as, say, Red China might do, or such as folks in Soviet Russia might have been doing for a while, to rewrite history. Because if you don't know where you came from, you're not going to go where you're going. So the importance of a history is to set in motion an awareness of where you stand in the flow of history. And I think American statists want us to see us as part of a flow into increased statism and increased power of the state, which then leads to utopia, more control, more blessings, as humanists paint them, more freedoms, which we call licentiousness, et cetera, et cetera. And when Christians have to then recover all these revised terms, the subversion of the terminology as well as the revised history, and bring them to the table. This is why one of Dr. Rushdoony's colleagues at the Volcker Fund, Verna Hall, spent so much of her energy and time going through all the original source material from the pre-revolutionary period into the early 1800s and pulling the data that's actually there. No one was doing this kind of work except she was doing it, and Dr. Rushdoony was aware of the value of it. And we need to have that kind of level of scholarship to push back against the slanders, which literally many of them are, that are imposed against the Christian influence on how the colonies formed and evolved, and how we eventually ended up where we are today by not following through, but rather rejecting wrongly and harmfully the biblical fountain of pure waters that actually would have led us to the right direction, and we just abandoned them in the interest of humanism. We abandoned biblical economics, and now I have a humanistic economics, and now we have $31 trillion in debt. And I guess our dollar from beginning of the 1900s is worth 2 cents now, whatever the amount it is very small. It's just indicative that we are debauching and destroying our currency, but we're told nowadays it's okay. So instead of these things being threats to the nation's safety, they're now seen as acceptable losses. Maybe you as a human being cannot have this kind of massive debt, but the United States of America can handle it on its back, even though it can never repay it. So we get all sorts of nonsense to us, and revisionist history, when it is attempting to divert us from the truth, pervert the truth, is a dangerous weapon, because no lie is of the truth, and therefore the purpose of the lie is to always institutionalize injustice. There is nothing good that is being created by a revisionist pattern. It's always a backward step, and it's always an immoral step, and consequently we are going to have dangerous consequences, and they're going to be irrevocable. So we have a choice to backtrack now and recover a biblical vision and apply it, especially at the local level where it has the most impact, or we can simply go with the flow, and the flow is heading over the cliff. It's a very nasty looking waterfall to me, and I don't think we should be piloting the boat and flooring it toward the falls. I think we need to be heading the boat back upstream where we came from, where the waters were pure and safe and formed a source of blessing. We don't have that anymore.
Well, for those of you who've tuned in, if you want more on this subject, go to calcedon.edu, and on the resource tab, put in The Nature of the American System. You'll find the book, you'll find an audio version of the book, And you'll even find a discussion from 2017 or 18 where a group of people got together and discussed the book. So maybe if at first you have this desire, well, I don't know if this is going to be too heady, you can go to many of our Book of the Month Club discussions and hear what people had to say about a book to, you know, help you get started. But I think both you, Mark, and you, Martin, would agree that all believers committed to the advancement of God's kingdom need to be well-versed in the things we're talking about. And that's why, regardless of how you were educated when you were younger, you need to get yourself educated if we want to see our country return to God in obedience, because it's more than just feelings. It has to be concrete obedience to what he says. So thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll join us next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chalcedon Podcast. To learn more about the ministry of Chalcedon, or to discover thousands of great Christian books, sermons, lectures, videos, newsletters, and more, just visit chalcedon.edu today.